talk today about insentient beings expounding the Dharma. Do insentient beings expound the Dharma? I'm going to start with one of Ehe Dogen's discourses, Dharma discourses. Translators have entitled this The Dharma Expounded by Non-Sentient Beings. I can remember when Dong Shang first visited Yunyan, he asked, "Who can hear the Dharma expounded by non-sentient beings?" Yunyan said, "Non-sentient beings can hear the Dharma expounded by non-sentient beings." Dong Shang asked, "Master, do you also hear it?" Yunyan said, "If I could hear it, you would not hear the Dharma I expound." Dong Shang said, "If so, then I do not hear the Dharma expounded by the Master." Yunyan said, "If you do not even hear the Dharma I expound, how can you hear the Dharma expounded by non-sentient beings?" Finally, Dong Shan offered a verse, saying, "How marvelous, how marvelous! The Dharma expounded by non-sentient beings is inconceivable. If you can listen with your ears, it will be difficult to ever understand. Hearing the sounds with your eyes, surely you can know it." This is a little interchange between the founder of the Soto school, Dong Shang, and his master. And the poem that he ends up making up on the spot is not his enlightenment poem, but it's considered a very important verse in his life. I'm going to read three different translations of that poem. Because each one, I think, adds a little bit of perspective. This one was translated by Taigen Lighten and Shohaku Okamura. I will repeat it. "How marvelous! How marvelous! The Dharma expounded by non-sentient beings is inconceivable. If you listen with your ears, it will be difficult to ever understand. Hearing sounds with your eyes, you can surely know it." So I should say, you really don't have to be listening to this Dharma talk at all. You don't have to listen. Another translation by Nishijima and Cross goes like this: "How very wonderful, how very wonderful. The non-emotional preaching is a mystery. If we listen with the ears, it is ultimately too difficult to understand. If we hear sound through the eyes, we are able to know it." And finally, another translation, and this one is by whoever translated the book this comes from. "How splendid, how wondrous, inconceivable. Insentient beings speak the Dharma. The ears never hear it. Only the eyes do." So I'm going to talk a little bit about this poem, the three translations of it. First of all, so it's talking about the Dharma expounded by insentient beings. First of all, there's this air of wonderment and mystery and marvelousness inherent in non-sentient beings speaking the Dharma. So there's that element of just inconceivability. Now that inconceivability is kind of a slap the side of the head, in that we can't get at this dharma through our concepts. We can't. It is inconceivable. It is not something that we can wrap our minds around in a conceptual thinking way. The way we can understand this dharma or hear it is by listening with our eyes. Well, I would say listening to sounds with our eyes, our spleen, our bladder, our toes. Not with the ears, but with our whole body, our heart, mind, and all of our organs, to listen in that way to the dharma being expounded. So a marvelous, inconceivable listening, not with our ears, but with our eyes, we can hear the dharma expounded by insentient beings. Now, insentient beings are, beings that sometimes. So one translation here is non-emotional being. Sometimes it's translated as inanimate or insentient. So these are beings that don't have consciousness. Oftentimes we don't think of things like the wood floor as a being. But in this case, the wood floor is a being, as is the wall, as is the pavement outside, are insentient beings. Nishijima translates it as non-emotional. How marvelous, how very wonderful the non-emotional preaching the Dharma is a mystery. And he, in his translation, Dogen used this story and this poem quite a bit, and he wrote an essay called The Non-Emotional. Again, Nishijima's translation is The Non-Emotional Preaches the Dharma. It's translated sometimes in other ways. Non-sentient beings preach the Dharma or expound the Dharma. But Mujo Seppo is the Japanese for Mujo is non-emotional or insentient. And Seppo is to preach the Dharma. And Nishijima says in his translation or introduction to this essay, Mujo Seppo, he talks about this idea of Mujo, or non-sentient or non-emotional. And he says it originally meant inanimate or insentient, but Dogen is using it as non-emotional. And he says Dogen's usage of the word Mujo was wider than the usual usage, as if the words cover the whole of nature, human beings as well as mountains, rivers, and so on. Master Dogen insisted that even inanimate things can preach the Dharma, and at the same time, he insisted that human beings can preach the Dharma when they are not emotional. One way to think of this is as we sit zazen, and thoughts and emotions come up, we let go of them, we are only able to expound the Dharma when we have let go of thoughts and emotions. So thinking, sentience, emotions, those are mental formations, and Dogen is saying that my words here and my concepts are not expounding the Dharma, and we fool ourselves if we think that's what's happening. But the Dharma is being expounded, but it's being expounded by all of nature around us, everything around us. Amy Clampett is a poet who got this, I think, and I will read a poem by her. And it's about it's called Shorebird Watching. And I want to explain a couple things in it so that it might be more understandable. So shorebirds, everybody knows what a shorebird are, those little birds that you see them on the beach when they're kind of running out when the wave comes in. They run in and they pick that little morsels in the sand. They usually have long legs. They are renowned for their many of them breed in the Arctic, and they're renowned for their long, long, long migrations. Some of them that breed in the Arctic actually spend their winters in southern part of South America. So these huge 10,000 or tens of thousands of miles migration. Some of them actually, some shorebirds actually migrate to the North American Arctic from southern tip of Africa. So across the ocean. They usually are the first birds here coming through. They'll be here very shortly, in a month or two. So she's watching birds. Just a couple things. She'll refer to dunlins and turnstones and golden plovers and black-bellied plovers. Those are all types of birds, of shorebirds. She also refers to the all thing on the thingstead. All thing is the Icelandic parliament, and thingstead is the building that Nordic Scandinavian parliaments meet in. So all thing is a Icelandic parliament, and thingstead is the building that Scandinavian parliaments meet in. So, here we go. Now remember, this is about insentient things, not emotional things expounding the Dharma. To more than give names to these random arrivals, teeterings and dawdlings of dunlin and turnstone, black-bellied or golden plover, all bound for what may be construed as a kind of avian all-thing out on the thingstead, the unroofed synagogue of the tundra, is already to have begun to go wrong. So to more than give names to these random arrivals is already to have begun to go wrong. What calculus, what turning, what unparsed telemetry within the retina, what overdrive of hunger for the night-long daylight of the Arctic are we voyeurs of? Our bearings gone, we fumble a welter of appearance of seasonal plumages that go dim in winter. These bright backs, tweeded saffron, dark underparts, the relic of what sibylline descents, what harrowings. Idiot savants, we've brought into focus such constellations, such gamuts of errantry, the very terms we're condemned to try to think in, turn into trespass. But Adam, drawn toward that dark underside, its mesmerizing circumstantial thumbprint, would already have been aware of this. So in this poem, there's the marvelous element. I mean, when she talks about what calculus, what turning, what unparsed telemetry within the retina, what overdrive of hunger for the night-long daylight of the Arctic are we voyeurs of? This incredible thing, a migration of shorebirds, tens of thousands of miles, done again and again and again, and having evolved over millennia. How does it happen? What happens in that bird's brain or liver or toes. What makes this amazing thing happen? There's this element of just marvelous wonderment at a bird migration, which we usually just don't even notice. And inconceivable. It is literally, although evolutionists and biologists kind of wrap their brains around it and try to understand it, but it really is inconceivable. I mean, we can kind of conceptually as human beings with our consciousness figure this stuff out, kind of make sense of it, make patterns of it. But as she says, idiot savants, we've brought into focus such constellations, such gamuts of errantry. The very terms we're condemned to try to think in turn into trespass. We don't have the words. We don't have the brain power to actually comprehend a shorebird migration. And I would say those insentient beings, that migration is expounding the Dharma. More than all of our books, more than all of our Dharma talks, that shorebird migration is the expounding of the Dharma, the unfolding of the Dharma. I'll read the poem one more time. To more than give names to these random arrivals, teeterings and dawdlings of dunlin and turnstone, black-bellied or golden plover, all bound for what may be construed as a kind of avian all-thing out on the thing's stead, the unroofed synagogue of the tundra, is already to have begun to go wrong. What calculus, what turning, what unparsed telemetry within the retina, what overdrive of hunger for the night-long daylight of the Arctic are we voyeurs of? Our bearings gone, we fumble a welter of appearance, of seasonal plumages that go dim in winter, these bright backs, tweeded saffron, dark underparts, the relic of what sibylline descents, what harrowings. Idiot savants, we brought into focus such constellations, such gamuts of errantry, the very terms we're condemned to try to think in turn into a trespass. But Adam, drawn toward the dark underside, its mesmerizing circumstantial thumbprint, would already have been aware of this. And that last verse, I think, in my interpretation, that's about Zazen. We're aware. I mean, at some level, we're aware of this. We are able to take it in, but not because we are it. We are it. Another take. So that's another Chinese take, I think, on this idea of insentient beings expounding the Dharma. This is a story about Shui Feng. Shui Feng was his nickname was Black Lacquer Bucket, or translation of that is Dimwit. He was one of the slowest Zen masters to kind of get up to speed. And so this is a story about after he had spent all those years not learning anything. This is an interaction with him and one of his students. Does anybody have a watch that I could borrow? So Shui Feng and his student is Chang Qing. I'll give you medicine to kill a horse. Can you swallow it? Chang Ching said he would do whatever Shui Feng recommended. "Then don't bother coming to me many times a day," the teacher said. "Just make yourself like a burnt stump on a mountainside. If you put your body and mind at rest for 10 years or maybe 7 or just 3, you'll surely discover something." Sometimes when I sit zazen, I probably shouldn't do this, but sometimes I do. I'll just imagine myself as a bush in a field, or a fence post, just there, just taking in whatever is happening, whether it's a bird call or sunlight or rain or a breeze, just there, in silence, in quiet. And I think that's what Shui Feng is telling Ching Chong, is to simply sit like a burnt stump. Sit like an insentient thing. Sit like a non-emotional thing. Bodhidharma, who is the we attribute Chan or Zen to Bodhidharma, as the founder of this school of Buddhism, and he's known for his sitting and facing the wall for 9 years. It's the way we practice here. We face the wall, not on Sunday mornings, but the rest of the time we just face the wall. And that's Bodhidharma is the fellow who kind of made that our practice. And sometimes we talk about it as simply seeing, just seeing, because we keep our eyes open, and but just seeing, the wall, sort of a blank movie screen right there. But sometimes we talk about this wall gazing as being a wall. Again, what as we sit and do our zazen, the wall is right there. And sometimes we think of, or it's, our wall gazing is described as being a wall. Again, simply being there, being silent, taking in what is arising in the moment. And so when we describe our zazen as wall gazing, or being like a wall, again, it's being like an insentient being. I guess I'd like to also make the point that when we talk about, the way this is useful to me is to de-anthropomorphize our practice. That our practice is one with the universe, and the universe is mainly made up of insentient beings. And it's not just beautiful nature that is expounding the Dharma, but it is the asphalt. I read a couple of weeks ago in the newspaper, the Sunday newspaper, that in the Twin Cities we put down 350,000
Well, it's a couple of weeks ago. My memory isn't
mm-hmm.
I think it was 350,000 tons of salt on our roads in the Twin Cities in a year. That's expounding the Dharma. Just as a beautiful bird song is an expounding of the Dharma, that salt going on the roads and into our water tables is expounding the Dharma. There's no separation. There's no separation. And so this non-sentient beings expounding the Dharma, I think, is a, for me, it's a powerful way to look at it, think about my practice day to day. Our practice, our Zen practice, is not an intellectual practice. Although there's a lot of books, there's a lot of writing, there's a lot of talking, there's a lot of that stuff going on. Our practice really is not intellectual. We talk about the cessation of mental formations and thoughts and ideas, and this deep silence where we can see into the, have insight into the essential nature of reality. Experiencing not in an intellectual way the oneness of shorebird migration. I've been watching the series on the National Park. Has anybody seen that Ken Burns series, National Park? Oh gosh, you guys should see it. Yeah, it's good, isn't it good? It's very good. And John Muir plays a major role in the second episode. And they have this guy who's a John Muir scholar. So John Muir is Scottish, and they have a John Muir scholar that looks exactly like John Muir, and when he reads, because they do long passages of Muir's writing, this guy reads it and he looks like John Muir and he sounds like John Muir. Anyways, I'm not going to try to put on my Scottish brogue for this. But this is a quote at the end of the second episode. As long as I live, I'll hear the birds and the winds and the waterfalls sing. I'll interpret the rocks and learn the language of flood and storm and avalanche. I'll make the acquaintance of the wild gardens and the glaciers and get as near to the heart of this world as I could. And so I did. I sauntered about from rock to rock, from grove to grove, from stream to stream. And whenever I met a new plant, I would sit down beside it for a minute or a day to make its acquaintance, hear what it had to tell. I asked the boulders where they had been and whither they were going. And when night found me, there I camped. I took no more heed to save time or to make haste than did the trees or the stars. This is true freedom, a good, practical sort of immortality. Good, practical sort of immortality. I think John Muir was getting at that idea of non-sentient beings expounding the Dharma. I think he got it. Inconceivable. We can't get our brains around it. But when we find complete silence, when we stop the chatter and the thinking and planning. And we let when we let our emotions simply arise and disappear, it's at that point that we see, we can see into essential nature at a non-conceptual level. One last quote, this one from Gary Snyder. And Gary Snyder here, and I've read this quote before. Gary Snyder is writing a commentary on Mountains and Waters Sutra, which is a sutra by Dogen. I think Dogen wrestled with this idea throughout his life. I mean, I think most of his teaching was about this. And so this is Gary Snyder making writing a commentary on Mountains and Waters Sutra. And the first line is the line that he's going to comment on. So this is Dogen's writing. If you doubt mountains walking, you do not know your own walking. So this sutra has mountains walking and waters walking, and I mean it's all this kind of stuff going on. And here he says, if you doubt mountains walking, you do not know your own walking. And now this is Snyder. Dogen is not concerned with sacred mountains or pilgrimages or spirit allies or wilderness as some special quality. His mountains and streams are the processes of this earth, all of existence, process, essence, action, absence. The mountains roll being and non-being together. They are what we are, and we are what they are. For those who would see directly into essential nature, the idea of the sacred is a delusion and an obstruction. It diverts us from seeing what is before our eyes, plain thusness. No hierarchy or equality, no occult and exoteric, no gifted kids and slow achievers, no wild and tame, no bound or free, no natural and artificial. This thusness is the nature of the nature of nature, the wild in the wild. So the blue mountains walk to the kitchen and back to the shop, to the desk, to the stove. We sit on the park bench and let the wind and rain drench us. The blue mountains walk out to put another coin in the parking meter and go down to the 7-Eleven. The blue mountains march out of the sea, shoulder the sky for a while, and slip back into the waters. You know, I think we can only, I mean, we can get at this stuff through our practice. And the whole purpose of a talk like this is to encourage you to practice. And poets can get at it, I think, in a way scientists can't, and the way pros can't. And I do think, I mean, Clampett and Snyder both kind of express that sense of insentient beings expressing the Dharma and insentient beings not being any different than sentient beings. We are mountains. We are the mountains walking. And as Dogen said, if you don't understand mountains walking, you don't understand your own walking. And I think when we our practice, our zazen, is really our effort to, wholehearted effort to understand at that level essential nature. And as John Muir said, it's also a good practical sort of immortality. Marvelous, marvelous, how splendid, how wondrous. The Dharma expounded by non-sentient beings is inconceivable. If you listen with your ears, it is difficult to ever understand. If you hear sounds with your eyes, you can surely know it. I'm done. Anybody have any comments or questions? Thank you. Phoebe. Hi.
Hi. Would you remind me of the name of the poet who wrote about the birds and the all things?
Amy Clampett.
Okay, is she Icelandic?
She's not.
Oh,
she's
okay.
She's American.
Okay.
Yeah. She's dead. She wrote. She was kind of a brainy kind of poet, and from kind of like, you know, the 50s, 1950s, 1960s. I think she like edited for, you know, some heady New York magazine. But she writes great poetry.
I think it was Robert Burns in Tiger.
Any other comments or questions? I'm not sure I understand the question, but let me try to answer it. I think recognizing that those negative kinds of things, like destroying our groundwater, dropping bombs, recognizing that that is unfolding of the Dharma, does not at all preclude having an opinion and a strong opinion that it's wrong and needs to be stopped and needs to be fixed, and we've got to use our human consciousness to for life as opposed to for destruction. I think one can still see the deep essential nature of the unfolding of the Dharma, and take action and make decisions and you know, have opinions. Did that help, or was that? Did I get okay? Good. And I think when you have that deep, I think that people like Nelson Mandela and Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King. I mean, I think people who come at their bring their deep understanding of the essential existential nature of reality to their political or their social engagement, I think it's incredibly powerful. Whereas I think people who don't see it oftentimes begin creating self and others, and you know, get into it becomes much more of having an opinion and wanting to bring about change that's driven by anger and hatred.
Remain silent, you know, with bringing along the connotation of there's sort of razor's edge there of bringing silence to it and taking care of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they're teaching.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to that, to your first point, yeah, this is the dharma. This is, you know, the three meanings of dharma. This is the dharma that I have been talking about in terms of, and Dogen was talking about here, is not the Buddha's teaching; it's essential reality, big D dharma. Does everybody know the three different meanings of dharma? Oh, yeah. One is essential reality, sometimes referred to as truth, and that's usually big D dharma. Then the dharma, which is the Buddha's teaching, and then the third term are the dharmas, the discrete elements of reality. And here we're talking about big D dharma, essentially. And it all doesn't make any difference. So, I mean, it's like
it shows how feeble we are that we think that changing from a lowercase to is like actually means something. Let's underline it for an explanation.
Idiot savants. That's what we are. You're gonna say something?
I wonder, the vague understanding of the story that at Buddha's enlightenment, that I was all being, and all something like that. And so that's bringing the big design into the dark.
One of the things Nishijima, and I think it's his interpretation, but I was quite struck by it, is that saying that Dogen used mujo or non-emotional being or non-sentient being as kind of through a wide net, which is not unusual for Dogen. I mean, you know, it doesn't just mean non-sentient beings; it means all of reality, all of nature, mountains and rivers and human beings and ants and worms and tables. But then he went a step further, at least Nishijima went a step further and said, basically he said, and human beings can expound the Dharma to the extent they're non-emotional. To the extent that we have let go of our talking and concepts and emotions. Well, I don't know that Dogen would go that far.
So but all the talking is just getting us to reminding us to practice. It's just we do this every week just to go practice. Might as well just say go practice.
Go practice.
We keep saying the same thing over and over again.
Any other comments? Or
I think it's kind of unfair because over the years I've heard Lee talk about the Dharma and talk about Buddhism with a lot of with heavy, my perception content of responsibility and value and emotion. So I think Rosemary's kind of picking on him. He's having to argue a point a little bit.
All right.